You're listening to By the Well, a podcast for preachers to help you preach the good news in your communities. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker. And here today joining us again, we're delighted to welcome back Brian Collier, a PhD student in Hebrew Bible at Whitley Theological College and an ordained minister in the Congregational Christian Church, Samoa. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you back.
Pleasure. So today we're focusing on two of the lectionary readings in particular, Genesis 32, 22 to 31, and then Matthew 14, 13 to 21.
So last week we saw Jacob was alone and had an encounter with God of a certain kind. And this week we're back with Jacob. He's alone again. And he's having a different sort of encounter with God. Brian, what would you bring out as the most striking aspects of this passage this week?
Yes, I think this is a story that's sort of well known throughout the various traditions. The details are quite clear. We have Jacob wrestling all night with this mysterious figure who is later identified as God. The story's, we know the details, but I think that for me, there is a transformation, obviously, that takes place of Jacob's character. But I think that we also see God in a rather, for me, a rather humorous form where God, not only does God take on human qualities and the human form, but God also takes on, for a slight instance, he takes on Jacob's persona. God takes on Jacob's persona as the trickster. Mm. And I think that was something that sort of stuck out for me.
Where do you see that in the text? Can you give us an example?
So in our reading, in Genesis 32, verse 23, verse 25, sorry. So when the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. The word that interested me there is the word there, struck, which has been translated in the NRSV from the Hebrew verb nigah. I found that interesting because a lot of instances of when that word occurs, it doesn't actually mean struck because it sort of tends to be a more rather rigorous type of action. But it's more like a slight touch.
Mm-hmm. A light touch.
But not violent or aggressive.
Yeah, not a violent or aggressive meaning. So this word is also used in Genesis 3, the tree of knowledge, where God instructs Adam and Eve not to touch,
right?
And that's the same word. So it can't be that God struck with force.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just a simple touch that led to the hip socket being dislocated. And I found that funny because if God had been struggling with Jacob all night, and you can imagine God in this human form, hence the struggle. For a slight moment there in verse 25, God sort of goes back to God's quality and then sort of touches the hip to dislocate, as if to say that God has cheated for a split moment there.
And used his divine power in a way?
Yeah, his divine power in a way. So, because he's been struggling with Jacob and it seems as if he's not going to prevail against Jacob. So for that split second, God is the trickster, which is quite funny to me.
It's a paradox. I think that's the right word. That God doesn't unambiguously win here.
Yeah.
we would expect that.
Yeah, we would. There's so many paradoxes in this. I mean, there's something of Jacob's character in this. This is the one who came out of the womb grabbing the heel of his brother.
That's right.
So there's something about the tenacity of Jacob that that I think is an interesting model for faith, that he just will not let go of this man until he's had some kind of answer, some kind of satisfaction, which is, he's asking for blessing, he's asking his name, he wants some answers. And, you know, there's something admirable in that.
Yep.
There's also something whether Jacob's just desperate here, because there's a huge vulnerability in the trickster stories we were talking before. You know, Jacob uses his human tricks to win. Here he's got nothing. It's just it's him and God in the night, and everybody else has been sent away.
And doesn't have his mother there to help him either.
No. I think we need to think about as well when we look at this particular part of his story is that there are really clear echoes with his reconciliation with Esau, which happens in chapter 33.
Yeah, coming up.
So he's full of anxiety about that coming, and we see in that chapter that he prepares all these gifts for Esau, and he also, in Jacob fashion, I think puts his two armies of people in separate places.
He's separated out.
So that if
he's got a backup plan.
Yeah, so that if Esau is, violently opposed to seeing his brother, that Jacob can get away safely. And there's also that parallel where face-to-face, so at the end of the struggle in 32, it's the same phrase used in 33 when he's face-to-face with his brother. So his life is struggle, this poor man, you know. I mean, I think he's all of us. I think we do this too. We hope and pray for God's presence in our life, and then when we find it might be there, we struggle against what it might mean.
That's right. I think that that whole anxiety that you touched on is significant here. You know, I think that was the whole sort of pretext to this was Jacob's anxiety over confronting Esau. And I think that if we read that this passage from that perspective, we can sort of see that this wrestling that's taking place is some sort of a preparation for Jacob when Jacob finally does meet Esau. And it's sort of makes it a lot more sense when it's common in Hebrew theology that, it's well-known Hebrew theology where if you see the face of God, you're supposed to die.
Yeah, Exodus 32.
But Jacob doesn't die here.
No.
And the whole question surrounds why didn't he die when he saw the face of God as he claims to have seen? Mm. But it's almost as if the answer to that is that he's seen God's face in a human form. That's not the answer, but that's my way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And to see that, it's almost as if to say that God is allowing him to see this as a way of preparing him to see Esau's face. When we read in Genesis 33, verse 10, finally he sees the face. And I think Jacob quite funnily says there that for truly to see your face is like seeing the face of God.
He might have
said that because he just seen the face of God.
I wouldn't want to anthropomorphize this too much, but there is a real sense that when we are struggling, like if we've wronged someone or we're in a difficult relational situation and we want it resolved and we've got a part in resolving it, we do grapple with God and ourselves.
That's right.
Really, about what we should be doing or what we could be doing or what the loving response is, where's the justice and all of that, before we encounter that person. So there's something quite profound about that, I think, at that level, the human level too. And maybe we should ask for a blessing of God while we're doing it and take a leaf out of Jacob's book.
That's right. Persevere like he does.
Bless me, God, while I get
going. There's a parable later on in the Gospels about persevering, being persistent. What do we make? I mean, there's tensions in this story between blessing and then the wound. Jacob walks away with a limp from this encounter. So it's left him changed, but changed at a number of levels. He's got a new name, which we could see as signifying that's a good thing. He's becomes Israel. But he's also got a limp. So the blessing isn't all like rainbows and bunnies playing in a field kind of thing. What do you make of that tension? Is there something about our encounters with the divine that actually...
It's an outright challenge to the prosperity gospel.
Yes, yes. Yeah. I'm sure these ancient authors had that in mind. I mean, they might have actually. Is there something in our encounter with God that does leave us deeply affected in a way that the world can see? I mean, how do we?
I think,
or am I?
You go, Brian. You're analyzing
this a bit much. Do you like that, Brian?
We'll
make you answer all the questions.
I have a bit of a response, but you go.
Well, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I mean, we are sort of meant to read that the injury that Jacob suffers. You know, etiologically.
Yes.
You know, I mean, this is after all, one of the many etiological stories in Genesis, used to explain a phenomenon. And here in verse 32, it's, you know, to explain why that the Israelites don't eat the thigh muscle on the hip socket.
Which is just this quirky little
that's
bit at the end of the story.
Yeah. But sometimes, you know, I mean, in relation to your question, you know, if we reimagine Jacob as a wrestler and as a fighter, there are sort of these sort of trophies, you know, of achievement that you sort of wear with pride, and for you know, in the fighting world, it can range from things like having sporting a bruised bruised eye, you know, or
a
war wound. Like it's something to show off and say, okay, I suffered this from this fight that I had with the great, you know, Mike Tyson or something like that. And you know, this injury that Jacob suffers, it sort of represents that, some sort of a trophy that, you know, hey, this was from my struggle with God.
I faced up to it.
Yeah. I faced up to it and I persevered and I prevailed. It's because it's you know, Jacob prevails here because he does get the blessing that he wanted, which was the whole reason he was grabbing onto to God in the first place, and he got it. Yeah. So he's wearing this injury with pride in a sense. So might be.
Did you want to add anything, Fran?
Only that I think, and I was thinking a bit about Lee Sale's book that we've mentioned before, and Any Ordinary Day. A couple of the people she spoke to in that book really, I think, did like suffer tremendous loss and anguish. But in the grappling with that, in reassimilating who they were or who they are in life, is a sort of, it's a wound, but there's a depth that you can see in people, I think.
So you can draw courage and meaning from that going
absolutely.
Forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And also there's a wound, the wounded healer is a well-known name of a book about Jesus. I think that sometimes, people who have been deeply wounded in ways grappled with God or are profoundly healing in the way they encounter others.
Can I also add? We in following on from the dream context of Genesis 28, you know, of his vision that he saw, that hip injury also reminds us that, you know, what Jacob experienced was real. It wasn't a dream. You know, the injury was in fact a reminder to him that, and
something had happened. Yes. Yeah, this wasn't just a vision.
Yes, and going back to the idea of suffering at all levels, you know, Jacob experienced the full brunt of suffering, but all in the anxiety, you know, the mental state and the psychological state, the spiritual, and then now you got physical. So he's experienced it all. And I think that whole transformation that takes place, that sort of grasps it all, that it was a full bodily, physically, mentally and spiritual
transformation. I'm thinking of Gethsemane when you speak like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that's Jesus' right. wounds.
Well, that's right.
And we worship a wounded God.
Yeah.
And the idea that body and spirit can be separated would have just been absurd to the Hebrews.
That's it.
Can I ask then, for people who might actually find themselves in the dark night, in the moment of struggle, is there a word of hope in this passage?
I would say so.
What is the word of hope? Yeah. What is the good news?
Yeah. To me, the whole daybreak that is looming is what's is sort of representative of that hope. You know, we sort of spoke earlier a bit about the whole anxiety of the dark time, being alone. But, you know, In the world we live in, we all know that daybreak, I mean, the next day, there's always a new day coming and it's something that we put our hope in. And it's actually a manifestation of our hopes, you know. So, you know, the fact that the narrative mentions that, you know, that they fought through the night and then daybreak came, that daybreak represents hope at the end. So like the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes. Yeah. That light will come.
That will come.
We don't. So, I mean, as much as I find the struggle Jacob goes through quite helpful for thinking about moments in my own faith where I've struggled with God and tried to bargain with God and wrestle with God and big questions of faith, there is also one certainly needs to know that the entirety of life will not be struggle.
That's
that,
right.
That there will also be moments of.
Well, the one of the final words here is the blessing.
Like, yes.
God blessed him.
That's and right.
That blessing will come.
I think it was Bill Loder, someone I was reading, said, and our response is worship. You know, that's the response to this story because God does, in the end, have the last word.
That's right.
And blessing.
But God does that in response to Jacob's struggle. You know,
seeing
the fight in Jacob, you know, then it's sort of a good, it serves a good reminder to us all that, you know, in our own struggles, you know, we got to learn to sort of persevere, you know, with the faith in the hope that will come. I mean, it sounds all sort of dramatic in a sense, but, you know, the fight that Jacob went through was a real experience. And it was only after his perseverance that God said, okay, well, you know, this guy has persevered. I think I should bless him. As opposed to the old Jacob, who was sort of manipulative, trying to rely on his own devices to gain all this and making shortcuts.
Mm. Yeah, he wanted blessing without the struggle.
Yeah, exactly.
He wanted the instant blessing.
But in this instance.
Which we do too, so let's be honest.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, but in this instance, he doesn't take the shortcut. He doesn't take he's not mischievous. He's not deceptive. He
hangs in there.
Yeah, that's it. He knuckles down and does the work.
I can't help thinking too in our current context, globally, communally. I mean, we're in Melbourne, so we're in a second lockdown in the COVID pandemic, and we're speaking to people who are everywhere, in various degrees. We're all in there is a struggle going on, like not just at the individual level, although there are people in apartments stuck for months and months. Mm. So there's something exquisitely pertinent about this story now and
that's right.
About the hope we're called to live, even if we don't believe that the blessing will come to us as it did for Jacob. The faith is to hold on to that and live like it's the case, you know, live eschatologically, to put it theologically.
Yeah, and the hope is by its very nature something that recognises the darkness we're currently in and that against all realistic facts in front of our face actually hopes that it can be different.
Is what for what cannot be seen, as Paul said.
That's right.
In Romans, it's which not, we're not looking at today.
No. Before we move on to Matthew, any last words on this?
I sort of, you know, I did notice that there was echoes of this being heard in the alternative reading.
In the Psalm?
In the Psalm. Psalm 17.
Psalm 17. Yes. Psalm 17.
And if you read through that Psalm, there's a lot of mention of this dependence of the psalmist upon God's face, upon seeing God's face, which is obviously there in the Genesis narrative. And, you know, relying on God's, seeing God's face as being this metaphor for salvation and for the person to sort of get over the tragedy and the circumstances of the bad circumstances that the psalmist is experiencing. And then in verse 15, the final verse, that's where the hope comes forth of finally experiencing and being satisfied by the sight of God's face. So, you know, I felt that this is all replicated there as well in the Psalm.
Yeah, so a nice parallel between those two Old Testament readings today.
I love the last line. When I awake, I shall be satisfied.
That's it.
Beholding your likeness.
I mean, doesn't that sound like the end of the struggle that Jacob
went
through?
Yeah, it sounds like it was written for Jacob.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it also takes us into the Matthew reading where everyone, astonishingly, in this feeding story, eats until they are satisfied. And it is, I mean, I'm not just being tacky, but there is a word there that means eats until they were satisfied, which is a really strong, powerful word and something incredibly rare in an ancient culture where you lived fairly hand to mouth unless you were wealthy. For most of these people, we assume to eat in the way that we often eat in the Western world, let's be honest, where we're utterly stuffed, you know, to eat to that level would have been a rare thing because food was scarce.
Well, the story preceding the one today, the feeding of the 5,000, is Herod's banquet, which would have been one of the rare examples of eating to beyond satiation. Is that the word? And I think it's important to know, well, to have a look at that passage before you get to this one. Only that I think there's a comparison going on here between Herod and Jesus and the nature of power.
Yep.
So Herod, you know, holds this big party and feeds people who've already got plenty, presumably. And here in this story, Jesus is feeding people who've got nothing and doing it abundantly and with massive generosity. And obviously Herod's being manipulative and awful and ends up killing John the Baptist.
Yes. I think if I was preaching this Sunday on Matthew, I would be inclined to read from the beginning of chapter 14 and include that story and actually, you know, title it in my brain at least, something like the story of two feasts.
Yeah.
Because these two feeding stories, as they effectively are actually deeply political as two visions of what where kingdom ethics get you.
Yeah.
So in the kingdom that Herod belongs in, you've got invited guests, select crowd, showing off abuse of power that ends up in death.
And overabundance is a sign of power.
Yes.
As well.
As wasteful food, that kind of stuff, that decadence. And yet in the Jesus kingdom, you've got a kingdom framed by compassion. Jesus is moved by deep compassion. Mm. An inclusive crowd. There are women and children. So our author only counts the 5,000 men, but then has a little note. And there were women and children.
The crowds were fairly self-seeking, however. But yes.
So they've come to be. They've come to be healed. Have some miracles. But you know, that's a sign of what the kingdom of heaven is, which is where everyone gets fed equally and everyone is satisfied, regardless of their status, gender, you know, place in the world. And so for people who've been following Matthew and preaching the parables, we've had several weeks in these kingdom of heaven type parables, and it might feel like we've shifted, but I guess I would want to say in some ways we're still with this idea of the kingdom of heaven, but this time instead of a parable, we have a miracle story that actually embodies the values of the kingdom.
I'm really struck by a couple of things I learned about the Greek in verse 15 in particular. Mm. Well, first there's the disciples' misunderstanding again, although Matthew doesn't portray them as negatively as the other gospel writers here.
Mm-hmm. No, Matthew does rescue but the disciples
like,
often.
Yeah, this is a deserted place and the hour is now like, send the crowds away so that they might go and buy food for themselves. And Jesus' response is, you give them. So apparently in the Greek it's you is a pronoun that is redundant.
It's emphatic.
It's emphatic. You don't need it, but it's basically really pinpointing them. No, they don't need to go and buy anything. You go and give them food.
Yep.
So so it's a real challenge of that, a challenge to that transactional in way we treat each other.
There's also something that's interesting in that feeding as well. I was just reading verse 35, then ordering the crowd to sit down on the ground.
Yep.
Immediately I sort of thought about, you know, you were mentioning in the banquet and with a banquet you have a table.
Yes.
But there's no table here.
No.
And I think, you know, I'm speaking from my own cultural point of view that, you know, first we don't sit on tables. We sit on the ground to eat.
Yeah.
And if you see the structure of a Samoan house, it's rounded to suggest that everyone is equal. And the whole idea of sitting on ground is that sitting on the ground resonates with a position of humility where everyone's on equal terms. And then just the whole, you know, the concept of the table can sometimes be a little bit elitist.
Completely. Yeah.
Where, you know, you've got people sitting at the front table and then you got everyone else sort of sitting where they're supposed to sit, you know.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's no table there is a sort of, for me, it's sort of speaking against that as well. The whole concept of elitism and you know, in this kingdom that Jesus is bringing, there is no such thing as being elite, and you know, everyone's
equal. Yeah, and that's another comparison, because all the literature, and there's lots of scholarly literature on ancient symposiums and, you know, these so Herod's feast would have had a table where there was a very clear hierarchy who sat at the sort of so-called head of the table, which was sort of central really, and who sat next to them, left and the right, those positions of influence and power.
Yeah.
It would be highly hierarchical.
That's right.
And all of that is done away with when you have, that's a nice image.
So, Robin, I think it's probably true to say that the miracle aspect of this story to modern ears have meant our ears have been closed to actually the profundity of this passage.
Yeah, I think so. I think I've probably heard a few too many sermons on, you know, this is a miracle of sharing, and if we all just pulled the food out of our pockets, everyone could eat. And there's a truth to that. Like, I mean, in our current world, if we all shared the food we had, everyone on the planet could eat.
But it's about God.
But this, I would say this is actually about the kingdom of heaven, the nature of God's kingdom, and it is eschatological. Mm. I mean, it reminded me of, say, Isaiah 25. There's lots of Old Testament passages that talk about this banquet when we go up to the mountain for the Lord, where, again, there's abundance. People eat until they're full.
And then there's leftovers.
Which is, again, a sign of the abundance of God, even though it comes from these very simple things like bread and fish. So it is eschatological, it is theological. I think it can get us to the same place. So I was thinking, again, you know, COVID-19 is revealing all sorts of injustices for us. And if I use one example just from Melbourne, where we live, we're seeing exposed in the current lockdown people who live in government-provided public housing, who have been locked down because there's an outbreak in some of those towers, and who are entirely reliant on whatever free food is delivered to their door that the government provides. And there's been certain reporting that it hasn't been enough, it hasn't been the right kind of food. There's various charities that have stepped in to cook culturally appropriate meals. So you've got people who are so vulnerable and just entirely dependent on whatever kind of stuff they're given. And then we've also got people in Melbourne and Melbourne's finest restaurants where you can get delivered for hundreds of dollars your restaurant quality food to your door if you can afford it and actually feast wonderfully at home. And I'm not criticizing people who do that. I know about that because I've looked at some of those restaurants. but it just points out the huge disparity we have that shows we are not that different to this world that Jesus is in. And I think from the theological and the eschatological here, we can get to the same sort of ethical imperative, which is what are we doing to share what we have and to feed those in our midst who do not have the abundance we have.
I think that's undoubtedly true, but I also think the power of this passage is a bit like in the same way the Jacob one is. That is, God's blessing is the last word in Jacob's encounter, and in this we have the absolute reassurance that God can feed abundantly and to the point of leftovers, which is the nature. So we don't live in scarcity. Our identity is not framed by scarcity as children of God.
Beautiful. That might be a great note to end it on. Thank you so much, Brian Collier, for being with us.
Thank you.
It's been great. Thank you.
You've been listening to By the Well. Thanks for listening.